Hello there. Today is Monday, February 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, lawsuits begin to pile in following President Trump's emergency declaration.
He's going to protect his national emergency declaration guaranteed.
As a humanitarian crisis deepens, a plan to get aid into Venezuela that could be a day of reckoning. A war of words between the U.S. and Iran at a security conference in Germany. Also ahead, the number one hit song 34 years ago today. It's all on today's International Edition. The White House Sunday defended President Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency to build a wall outside the U.S.-Mexican border to thwart illegal immigration, even though he said he didn't need to do it. Trump advisor Stephen Miller, an immigration hardliner, defended the president on Fox News Sunday.
Congress in 1976 passed the National Emergencies Act and gave the president the authority as a result of that to invoke a national emergency in many different circumstances, but among them for the use of military construction funds.
He said Trump's action is defending our own borders and called illegal immigration a threat in our country.
We have families and communities that are left unprotected and undefended. We have international narco-terrorist organizations. This is a threat in our country, not overseas, not in Belarus, not in Zimbabwe, not in Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq, but right here.
Trump invoked the emergency powers on Friday after Congress refused his request for $5.7 billion to help build the wall that was a signature 2016 campaign promise. The White House says Trump will have access to about $8 billion. Meanwhile, lawsuits challenging the action are already being filed to block his transfer of money. Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd, whose district is on the Mexican border, tells ABC's This Week that many of his constituents could lose their property.
Our government was designed for the most ultimate power, the power of the purse, to reside within Congress. And we shouldn't have an executive, I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat, that tries to get around Congress with this national emergency declaration.
And California Attorney General Javier Becerra said Sunday on ABC's This Week that the state will challenge the order in federal court. And he cited Trump's own comment Friday that, quote, he didn't need to do this as evidence that the emergency declaration is legally vulnerable.
It's clear that this isn't an emergency. It's clear that in the mind of Donald Trump, he needs to do something to try to fulfill a campaign promise.
Miller said that more than 320 kilometers of the border wall will be built by the end of September 2020, just weeks before Trump stands for re-election to a second four-year term. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump tweets that Islamic State caliphate is ready to fall. U.S. Taliban meeting in Pakistan is canceled. Saudi Arabia's crown prince signs a $20 billion investment deal in Pakistan, and a festival connects the African diaspora. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Economic, political, and humanitarian crisis in Venezuela is reaching a critical level as a U.S. delegation, including Republican Senator Marco Rubio, visited the Colombian border city of Cúcuta on Sunday. It's where humanitarian aid is being stockpiled for planned delivery to Venezuela next week. Up to now, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has refused to allow in food, medicine, and other supplies. Standing near a pedestrian bridge on the border between the two countries, Rubio called the Maduro government a criminal regime that is willing to starve and kill its own people in order to stay in power.
Over 50 countries stand with the people of Venezuela, and we will not abandon you. So long as you are on the side of freedom and liberty, the world and America will stand with you each and every step of the way.
Opposition leader and self-declared President Juan Guaido has vowed to move hundreds of tons of the aid into the country on February 23rd. Joining us to talk more about the situation is Carlos Morero, associate lecturer at the School of Politics and International Relations at the Australian National University. How dire is this situation becoming? It seems like it is really reaching a critical point here.
The situation has probably worsened in recent weeks. Recent announcements of U.S. sanctions and the like have probably made it even harder for the government now to bring in foodstuffs and do the work of running the state, right? So these things were difficult before. They've become harder for the last couple of years. The difficulties in the Venezuelan economy have meant that the Venezuelan state has basically seen its budget reduced to about half, if not less. And this meant that hospitals, for example, have been low on medical supplies. All sorts of patients, that require, from cancer patients to HIV patients, et cetera, haven't been able to receive or find the medicines to treat these ongoing conditions. Unless you're fortunate enough to have friends or family who are crossing the borders or who are coming from overseas, it's very, very hard to find, these sorts of medical supplies. The hospitals are also, by and large, understaffed, and because many doctors and nurses basically can't survive on the very, very low wages that we have in Venezuela right now, around $8 or $9 a month, when probably any Venezuelan would need it close to $100 a month to survive. So we've seen thousands of doctors and nurses and other professionals leave the country as part of a general exodus that has seen close to 2.3 million or perhaps more or so Venezuelans leave in the last 3 years. And then, of course, the crisis that has to do with the lack of basic foodstuffs. For example, a really kind of harrowing statistic tells us that by the end of 2017, Venezuelans had lost on average 11 kilos of body mass, substantial underconsumption of food. And if you go to Venezuelan supermarkets, you will find some goods, but a lot of basic goods aren't available. Or if they are available in some places, they're now available at prices that are just far beyond the reach of ordinary Venezuelans. So you're talking about a carton of eggs at about $7 or $8, when, as I said, minimum wage is about $8 or $9. Mm. So you might find products, but not many Venezuelans can afford these unless they're getting help from overseas.
We are hearing that Juan Guaido has vowed to move hundreds of tons of this aid that's being stockpiled into the country on February 23rd. What's going to change that day?
So the 23rd of February has been picked, been put forward as a significant date. It's a month after the 23rd of January, right, which is the date when this kind of new moment of political tension and crisis in Venezuela began. So on the 23rd of January, as listeners will remember, this is when Juan Guaido proclaimed himself interim president and was speedily recognized by a series of South American states, but also, of course, most importantly, by the United States, by President Donald Trump. And the 23rd of February is now being put forward as a way of bringing things to a head. So on the 23rd of February, Juan Guaido has said that this will be the day in which aid will enter the country. And he's ordered the military to let the aid in, right? Assuming his role as interim president, he's going to put forward the order. Now, of course, whether the military allow this to happen, that's another issue. But it is a difficult situation for, ordinary soldiers, we're going to have low-ranking military who are on the border, having to kind of face the situation. Many of these people live, seeing their family, experiencing these kind of everyday difficulties throughout the country. So the 23rd of February is being put forward as a date in which things will escalate. Guaido has ordered that this aid be let in. The aid comes back by the U.S. government, and at the same time, the government of Maduro is clearly referring to this aid as a pretext for military intervention. So things are certainly tense. On the other hand, the opposition have also taken steps to try and organize support for this U.S. humanitarian aid to enter the country. So reports say that we have currently something like 17 camps throughout the country, and that thousands of doctors and nurses have kind of registered as a kind of a volunteer group to deliver the aid. In a larger figure, between 300 and 600,000 or so Venezuelans have registered to help to have the aid cross. So perhaps by mobilizing opposition supporters around the question of aid, they might be able to defuse the violence, and they might be able to perhaps win the government and avoid violence in what could be a flashpoint.
All right. That's Carlos Moreo, associate lecturer at the School of Politics and International Relations at the Australian National University. The Haitian government is vowing to deepen the investigation into alleged corruption in the Petrocaribe oil program and to reduce its expenses, seeking to meet some of the protesters' demands as demonstrations have continued to roil the country. During a televised address on Saturday night, Prime Minister Jean-Henri Sion announced 9 measures aimed at alleviating the country's economic crisis. He said the government will reduce its expenses by 30%, meet with the private sector to try to raise the minimum wage, and appoint a new director to intensify the investigation into alleged corruption by Petrocaribe. Since February 7th, thousands of demonstrators have called for the president and prime minister to resign and for an independent probe into the whereabouts of the funds from Petrocaribe's agreement, an alliance between the Caribbean countries and Venezuela. Since the protests broke out, several foreign governments, including the U.S. and Canada, have urged citizens to avoid travel to Haiti. Demonstrations are expected to resume again this week. Iran says Europe's efforts to keep the 2015 nuclear deal are failing, and there's growing support among the Iranian people to restart the country's atomic program. Speaking to delegates at the Munich Security Conference Sunday, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told delegates, accused the United States and Israel of seeking war with this country after withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal last year.
I think the United States administration is not doing anything but regime change. Only regime change. It wouldn't have withdrawn from JCPOA the way it withdrew from JCPOA had it not had the illusion that there will be regime change within a month.
Zarif says the U.S. is the single biggest source of destabilization in its neighborhood.
We have long been the target of an unhealthy fixation, let's say an obsession, which continues to this very day. The demonization of my country has been a convenient cross for 7 consecutive American presidents to bear.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, earlier at the same conference, accused Europe of helping to prop up a murderous regime in Tehran.
The time has come for our European partners to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and join us as we bring the economic and diplomatic pressure necessary to give the Iranian people, the region, and the world the peace, security, and freedom they deserve.
But Pence's hard-hitting speech in Munich has triggered fears in Europe that Washington does, in fact, have bigger plans. An analyst with the European Union Institute for Security Studies argued that Pence's comments were not a call for a renegotiation, but rather let's remove the regime of Tehran, something Europe would not accept. U.S. President Donald Trump is hailing progress in ongoing trade talks with China, with negotiators set to meet again this week in Washington as the March 1st deadline approaches.
It's going extremely well. Who knows what that means, because it only matters if we get it done, but we're very much working very closely with China and President Xi, who I respect a lot. Very good relationship that we have. And we're a lot closer than we ever were in this country with having a real trade deal.
However, the U.S. president seemed to walk that back a bit when he told reporters it's going to be better than any deal that anybody ever dreamed possible, or he's not going to have the deal. So, is there progress or is there not? This is what VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Jeff Moon, China trade consultant and former assistant U.S. trade representative for China in the administration of former President Barack Obama.
I think there's been incremental movement, but the way the talks have been set up, with Trump saying that he's not going to decide until the end, that the Chinese are holding all the real cards until the end of the negotiation, and that they won't budge very much. By all outside accounts, the Chinese are willing to make progress on the market, some of the market access issues. That includes purchases of things like soybeans and energy products, and perhaps opening some sectors like the financial sector is what's most frequently mentioned. But they are not addressing the real core underlying issues in the dispute, which is China's industrial policy, which leads to IPR theft and a variety of other abuses. And so they're holding, China never really reveals its cards until the end, and Trump has made it clear that he will be the one that's just going to decide, and he's given them no real incentive to bring their cards to the table until he and she meet.
Well, he, meaning Trump, has already said he might very well extend the deadline for increased tariffs to go into effect. Is that not something being offered to the Chinese?
Not at this point. I think that they're going to wait until March the 1st to decide that. I don't think there'll be a real signal on that until the very last minute. I think that that is the most likely scenario, however, and I hope that that's what happens, because in fact, if they're going to address the industrial policy issues, it's not possible to resolve those issues in 2 weeks. Those are very complex issues that require longer talks. So from the perspective of the core American issues, a quick settlement is not a good settlement. It just glosses things over. And frankly, if the trade dispute wraps up without industrial policy issues being addressed, then that just carries those issues over beyond the current tariff dispute. And that's going to get very messy and very aggressive as that plays out over the longer term. It's much better for the negotiators to work out an orderly resolution of those issues than to leave them hanging over, and then we're going to get into an unpredictable, messy phase where all sorts of uncoordinated retaliation comes as a result of inability to address those problems.
Where do you think China stands on this?
I think China's hoping to, one, wait Trump out. They're buying for time. They're hoping they'll wait out, as much of his term as they can. I think they're hoping that perhaps also with time, the economics in both of the markets will lead Trump to perhaps come to a deal that's easier rather than harder. And I think that they are extremely resistant to change what they see as their socialist economic system. The problem is that China, one, was supposed to morph from a state-led economy into a market-led economy as a part of its WTO accession, and it just hasn't done that. And second, when China came into the WTO, it was very much a developing country. It is now very much a developed country, the second largest economy in the world, and it got breaks when it came in that it no longer deserves. It should not be able to close off large sectors of its economy to foreign competition like it did when it needed a leg up in the world economy. So we need to marketize or bring market principles into the equation, and China needs to finally open up its market.
How much of this is economics and how much of this is politics on either side?
I think it's mostly about economics. I think that unfortunately, Trump has allowed a lot of politics to enter into this. In previous administrations, trade was on its own lane. It did not intersect with things like North Korea or other issues. And what has happened is that Trump has allowed other issues to enter into the equation, some of them political. And that has sort of muddied the negotiations and made it difficult to sort out what can be done and how to move forward in an orderly way. And that's very problematic. We really should get back to having trade issues be trade issues and other issues be separated out, because there is no major problem in this world where the United States and China don't need to talk to each other. And separating those issues out separately allows us to deal with them more effectively.
So did I just hear optimism or pessimism?
Neither, really. I just think the realistic approach is that the deadline gets extended and probably goes into late this year, the negotiations, I would suspect.
That's Jeff Moon, former assistant trade representative for China in the Obama administration, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman, as both countries prepare to regather this week in Washington with the reported goal to reach a memorandum of understanding before the March 1st deadline. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices. Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. A team of Australian paleontologists and volunteers have saved a once-in-a-lifetime fossil discovery from devastating floods in Queensland state. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The dinosaur tracks give a rare insight into an ancient world. Found on an outback farm near the Queensland town of Winton, 1,100 kilometres from Brisbane, they're estimated to be almost 100 million years old. The footprints are stamped into a large slab of sandstone rock and were made by a sauropod, a giant creature with a long neck and tail, and by two smaller dinosaurs. Some of the footprints are up to a metre wide and come from the Cretaceous period. Scientists were alerted to the danger posed to this remarkable collection when it was partly damaged by severe flooding last year. For 3 weeks, scientists and volunteers worked to carefully dig up and relocate the dinosaur tracks. They're being stored at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum in Winton, where they will eventually go on display. David Elliott is the museum's executive chairman.
We really want to preserve the integrity of the tracks. We don't want to just tear them up and go and plonk them on the ground somewhere. You know, they have to be done a certain way. We can't just leave it here because that's, you know, find of a lifetime.
Dinosaur tracks are rare in Australia. Steve Porripat, a paleontologist at Swinburne University in Melbourne, says the footprints were saved from recent monsoonal flooding in Queensland.
The imperative was to get those soft footprints out of the ground because they just wouldn't have lasted in another flood now that they've been fully exposed. To get it all out of the ground to make sure that it's safe from future floods is fantastic.
Monsoonal rains in Queensland have caused chaos, flooding hundreds of homes and drowning several hundred thousand livestock. Officials said it was a one-in-a-100-year event and they've warned it could take years to rebuild the local cattle industry. As the floodwaters recede on land, they're polluting parts of the Great Barrier Reef. Experts say plumes of polluted water are stretching up to 60 kilometres from the coast, putting more pressure on coral that suffered mass bleaching in recent years. When ocean temperatures increase, corals can expel the algae that live in their tissues, causing the coral to turn completely white. The Great Barrier Reef is Australia's greatest natural treasure and stretches 2,300 kilometres down Australia's northeast coastline. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Billed as the largest and longest-running auto show in North America, the Chicago Auto Show this year is showing a notable change in the kinds of vehicles on display at the city's McCormick Place Convention Center. As VOA's Keane Farabaugh reports from Chicago, the shifting preferences of consumers is driving the kinds of vehicles manufacturers are producing and marketing.
On our commitment to passenger cars.
A special preview for members of the media at the annual Chicago Auto Show is a chance for manufacturers to show off their latest and greatest products about to enter the market. But what is notable about this year's show is what some manufacturers aren't showing off, new sedans.
So over 10 years now, there's been a consistent movement of customers in the United States and around the world, but even more so in the United States, moving away from sedans, more traditional passenger sedans, into more utility vehicles.
Joe Hinrichs is president of Ford Motor Company's global operations.
They like the ride height, seating height, the utility of the vehicle, and now we can give them the fuel efficiency they used to get in sedans. So that's where customers are going. Nearly 7 out of 10 vehicles sold today are trucks or SUVs in the U.S. market, and we'll continue to go where the market's going, where the customers are.
But while Ford is giving new options for consumers, it is also taking away models of the Focus, Fiesta, and Fusion cars ending production later this year.
Well, we've been planning our business to incorporate the expectation that some of those cars would go away and then bring in new products to the market.
We have the debate a lot about, is a compact SUV the new family sedan? And in many instances, you could say yes.
The prominence and choices of SUVs, crossovers, and trucks in General Motors' current lineup stands in contrast to its perennial auto show attraction in recent years, the Chevrolet Volt. The Volt was the top-selling electric plug-in vehicle of all time, but recent sagging sales have led GM to cease production of the Volt in March.
Volt was a great product for us, had a great run, two generations, but what has happened is, as the ability to produce pure electric in the kind of cost, configuration, and range what people are looking for, Volt had its time, but was a great stepping stone for us to lead to the future, which is pure electrification.
Chevrolet does plan to keep making a similar sounding car, the Bolt, an all-electric vehicle, and the midsize sedan Malibu, among a few other options.
So we're not abandoning the car market completely. We're right-sizing our portfolio. We're reacting to what the consumers are looking for.
What they are looking for are trucks and SUVs, which made up about 70% of the 17 million vehicles sold in the U.S. in 2018, a trend expected to continue this year. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Finally, on this day in music history, February 18th, 1984, the band Culture Club's hit song Karma Chameleon, featuring Boy George, shot up to number one on the Billboard chart and on Casey Kasem's American Top 40. It stayed in that lead spot for 6 weeks. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
You used to be so sweet, I heard you say that my love was an addiction.
This is VOA News. I'm